By the way, the thought just struck me before we get started. Sometimes people ask why I don't do topical teachings. And occasionally we do. We'll take a theme or a topic and we'll just go with that. What I generally do is take a book of the Bible and go through the book. And the reason for that is this. How do I know what topics God wants me to talk about all the time? And if we just talk about the topics I want to talk about, then I'll probably turn out omitting the topics God wants to talk about. But when we take a book of the Bible and go through it, we see the things that God wants to speak to us about. I don't get to pick and choose. You understand? So this is why, this is the backbone of how I go about things. We take a book, we go through it. We try to understand. Because otherwise, if we just pick the things I want to talk about, the themes I want to talk about, then we might be missing the things God wants to talk about. And so that's why we do that. So if anyone asks you a question of how or why that's how Beth Tikkun operates, now you have the answer. All right, so Genesis chapter 31. And as you know, Jacob has pulled up stakes. He and his wives, his 11 sons, how many daughters, we don't know, servants, maidservants, herds, flocks, and they've started to take off to go back to the land of his father Isaac, back to Canaan. And in verse 22, it says, it was told to Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled. So he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him at a distance of 7 days, catching up with him on Mount Gilead. But God had come to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, beware lest you speak with Jacob either good or bad. And we discussed that a little bit last week. Laban overtook Jacob. Jacob had pitched his tent on the mountain while Laban had stationed his kinmen on Mount Gilead. Laban said to Jacob, what have you done that you have robbed my heart? You've stolen my heart. This is the second time that phrase is used in this chapter. It was used back in verse 20 where it says, Jacob stole the heart of Laban. Your translation probably says deceived him. But in the Hebrew, it's that word ganav again, to steal. He stole his heart. How do you get your heart stolen? That's when you entrust it to untrustworthy things. And when you trust a deception, and then that deception proves to be a deception, part of your heart is kind of taken away from you. And of course, in Matthew 6, the master tells us, don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where rust and moth corrupt and thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures where? In heaven, where moth and rust don't corrupt. Thieves don't break through and steal. For where your treasure is, your heart will be also. So when you put your heart in treasures that can be destroyed or rusted or stolen or eaten away, you're going to get your heart stolen. So invest your heart in eternal things, in the invisible realm. Invest your heart in God and in his kingdom and in his truth. And I guarantee no one can lay a hand on your heart and take it from you. But Laban's heart was invested in earthly things, as we're going to see. So he says, why have you stolen my heart and led my daughters away like captives of the sword? Did Jacob lead them away like captives of the sword? No, we read last week how he consulted them and explained to them what things had been like. And he shared with them the logic of what he thought they should do, and they all agreed, yes, this is what we need to do. Let's get out of here. He didn't use any threats with them at all. Why have you fled so stealthily and robbed me? Nor did you tell me, for I would have set you off with gladness, with songs, with timbrel, with lyre. Yeah, right. And you did not even allow me to kiss my sons and daughters. Now you have acted foolishly. There's the first appearance of the word fool or foolish in the scriptures. The Bible has a number of terms for the word fool. There's the word evil. I think that's where we get our English word evil. There's the word Nabal, which Laban's name, if you spell it backwards, spells Nabal, fool, because that is what he is and was. There's also the word kasil, which is the most common word used in the book of Proverbs for fool. And there's probably some other ones as well. I haven't explored and studied all of them, but what we're going to look at in this chapter is the fact that Laban is indeed the model fool, if there is such a thing. And if you want to understand what a fool is, you go to this passage and you read and study the life of Laban. All right? Because Laban was a fool. And we're going to get to that in a moment. Let me show you something here I think is kind of fascinating. This is what Laban said to Jacob. You have acted foolishly. And the word foolishly is sachal. Sachal. But you know there are two Hebrew words that are pronounced exactly the same. Sachal. There's one on the left and one on the right, as you can see on the screen. But they could not be more opposite in their meanings. The word on the left, sechal, spelled with the shin, this letter here, that first appears in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3, where Eve sees the fruit and it says it was the delight to the eyes and that the tree was desirable to make one haskil, from the word sechal, make one wise. The real word there is prudent, understanding, insightful. So I'm going to put the word prudent there. But the word sachal spelled with a samek is the word for foolish. Now what's so foolish about this statement is Laban tells Jacob, you acted foolishly. But who's the one who told Jacob to act exactly the way Jacob acted? God did. We read that last week. God told Jacob, leave. Get up. Take your family. Go. So Jacob consults with his wives. They get up and they go. They did exactly what God told them to do. But then Laban comes along, who knows better than God, says, you acted foolishly. When you follow God, fools will always tell you that you're acting foolishly. You give away how much of your income? That's foolish. Think what you could do with that. Well, I am thinking what I could do with it. I'm invested in his kingdom. You don't work on Saturdays? That's 1/7 of your week. You're just giving away. No, I'm invested in his kingdom. Spending it with my creator, my redeemer. You don't eat pork? You don't eat shellfish? It's so tasty. And I suppose adultery is also fun, but I don't do that either. Because I want to please him. I'm a tabernacle of his spirit. You understand? We can go on and on and on and on and on. And when you obey the Lord, it'll look foolish in the eyes of this foolish world. That's just the way it's going to be. So, we're going to move on, though, with our chapter. By the way, that word sakal with the shin, this one on the left here, in our daily prayers, in the morning prayers, I'm sure many of you are familiar with this. We pray, you, we're praying to God, you favor man with knowledge and teach understanding to mortal men. Favor us with knowledge, understanding, and sakal, discernment, is that we often translated. Blessed are you, Adonai, gracious giver of knowledge. This word sakal. But I want you to look at the difference in the letters. Just look at the difference in the letters. This word on the right here, sakal, which means foolish, look at the samek. It's all enclosed. Nothing can penetrate. It's the only letter, standard letter of the 22, that's completely enclosed like that. Now the final form of the letter mem is also enclosed. But of the 22 standard letters, this is the only one that's closed in. Nothing can penetrate. And you know what? That's what a fool is. He's one where nothing penetrates. Logic is futile. So don't waste your breath. But look at this letter over here, the shin. The shin is open, and look, it's reaching up. It's reaching upward. It's called the letter of fire. It looks like a flame just reaching upward to God. It's pointing up all the time. But the stomach is just enclosed. Nothing penetrates. Anyways, back to the reading. Verse 29, Laban says, "It is in my power to do you all harm." Wait a minute, who's the bad guy here? Jacob or all the people with Jacob? Look at how he's boasting in his threats. "I could harm all of you. But the God of your father addressed me last night, saying, 'Beware of speaking with Jacob, either good or bad.'" Well, I think he's already spoken some bad to Jacob, don't you? I think he's already kind of broken the advice that God had given him in the dream. Verse 30, "Now, you have left because you longed greatly for your father's house." I understand you, Jacob. I get it. I understand. I could wipe you guys all out. But I tell you what, I'll give you a break today. I understand. This is how a fool talks. A lot of bluster. "Yeah, but why did you steal my gods?" There's that word steal again. "Why did you steal my gods?" "Jacob answered and said to Laban, 'Here's why I left. Because I was afraid, for I thought perhaps you might steal your daughters from me. But with whomever you find your gods, he shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, ascertain for yourself what is with me and take it back.'" Now, Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. And we're going to address the question, why did Rachel steal her father's idols? They're called teraphim here. That word's only used a few times in the scriptures. It's teraphim. And why'd she take them? We'll look at that. So hold that question, and we'll look at that in a moment. But notice that Jacob says, "With whomever you find your gods, he shall not live." He didn't know Rachel stole Laban's gods, and she did not live long. In just a few chapters, she will die in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin, the 12th and final son of Jacob. She's the youngest of the two sisters, but she dies first. She dies before any of the others. And I think one of the reasons was because of this. Jacob spoke a curse, not knowing on whom it would land. So verse 33, Laban came into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maidservants, but he found nothing. When he had left Leah's tent, he came into Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the teraphim, put them into the camel's pack saddle, and sat on them. Now there's a way to worship idols. Just sit on it. I can't think of a more appropriate way to deal with an idol. But anyways, Laban rummaged through the whole tent, but found nothing. She said to her father, "Let not my lord find it annoying that I cannot rise up before you, for the way of women is upon me." And there's no reason to doubt that that might be true. Thus he searched, but did not find the teraphim. That word, he searched, it's one word in Hebrew. It's vaychapes. It's only found two times in the Bible. It's here where Laban is looking through Rachel's belongings, trying to find his gods. It'll be used later in Genesis when Joseph sends a servant to look through the bags of grain that the brothers are taking back home. And in Benjamin's sack, he finds his cup. And who's Benjamin's mother? Rachel. See, the two stories are connected. And I'm sure the brothers must have thought, yeah, we know his mom's the one who stole the gods. And now here, like mother, like son, here he's stealing stuff that Joseph uses to, or they didn't know his name was Joseph, but that the Lord of Egypt uses to divine, because that's what Joseph had said to them. Okay, there's a connection. Hold that connection for a moment, and let's move on. Verse 36, finally Jacob gets angry. Then Jacob became angered, and he took up his grievance with Laban. Jacob spoke up and said to Laban, "What is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? When you rummaged through all my things, what did you find of all your household objects? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen. Let them decide between the two of us. Now notice what a fool does. He dodges the question. We haven't got done with Jacob yet. You'll see what a fool does in just a second. Verse 38, Jacob continues, "These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and she-goats never miscarried, nor did I eat rams of your flock. That which was mangled I never brought to you. I myself would bear the loss. From me you would exact it, whether it was stolen by day or stolen by night. This is how I was. By day, scorching heat consumed me, and frost by night. My sleep drifted from my eyes. This is my 20 years in your household. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wage 10 times. Had not the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the dread of Isaac been with me, you would surely have now sent me away empty-handed. God saw my humiliation and the toil of my hands. So he admonished you last night." Okay, now Jacob, or Laban just dodges the question. Then Laban spoke up and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters." Well, they were his daughters until he gave them away as Jacob's wives. Now they belong to Jacob. But Laban's a fool. In his mind, they're still mine. And then he goes on and says, "The children are my children." Well, they're Jacob's children. You're the grandpa, but they're his more than yours. But then he doesn't stop there. "The flock is my flock." No, it isn't. This is what you paid to Jacob. "And all that you see is mine." See, here's how the fool's mind works. When Jacob came to Laban, he had nothing except for the clothes on his back and the staff in his hand. He had nothing. Now he's leaving. He's got 4 wives, 11 sons, daughters, flocks, herds, camels, servants, maidservants. He's a wealthy man as he goes out. In Laban's mind, everything Jacob has is Laban's that was stolen from him. You see how the fool's mind works? But he didn't steal a thing from Laban, not one single thing. God blessed Jacob in spite of Laban. And all of Laban's efforts to cheat Jacob and to destroy Jacob and reduce him to nothing, they were futile. But Laban still can't see it. He's so blind, as fools always are. "Everything you see is mine. Yet to my daughters, what could I do to them this day? Oh, I'm so kind, though. I should just take all of this back, because it really is mine. You caught me in a good mood. You can have it, Jacob. It's yours. But what can I say? Or to their children whom they have borne. So now, come, let us make a covenant, I and you. And now here's the question. And it shall be a witness between me and you, or he shall be a witness between me and you." That's the question. Some translations say it, some say he. The reason for that is that the word for covenant is feminine. Yet the word there for it or he is masculine. So what is it that's supposed to be the witness between them? It's a good question. Not sure. So take it both ways. So maybe God is the one who's the witness between them. Verse 45. Now look at this. "Jacob took a stone." Who took the stone? Jacob. "And raised it up as a monument." Who did that? Jacob. "And Jacob said to his brethren, gather stones." Who gathered them? Jacob's brethren. Those are the men who are with Jacob, his servants and so on. "So they took stones and made a mound. And they ate there on the mound." Laban called it, and this is a long Aramaic term, Yagar Shehaduta. But Jacob called it Gal Ed. Gal, a mound of aid, of witness. That's Hebrew. And then look what Laban says in verse 48. Laban declared, "This mound is a witness between me and you today." Therefore, I called its name Gilead or Galed, And as for the Mizpah, because he said, may Adonai keep watch between me and you when we are out of reach, out of each other's sight. If you will ill-treat my daughters. Now, this is what's interesting. Laban says, if you will ill-treat my daughters. Who's the only one who's ill-treated his daughters? Laban did. When he gives Rachel, or, you know, Jacob goes up the aisle or whatever, however they did it, and marries Rachel. But then when he goes into her tent, oh, it was Leah that was swapped. Who did that? Laban. How did two daughters forgive their father for such a thing? If you will ill-treat my daughters, or if you will marry wives in addition to my daughters, oh, wait a minute. I got the extra wives because you, Laban, I had no intention of marrying any others than just Rachel. You know, you're the one who made me have multiple wives. Though no man may be among us, but see, God is a witness between me and you. And Laban said to Jacob, here is this mound and here is the monument which, who? I have cast between me and you. He didn't have anything to do with it. Jacob raised up the stone. Jacob's men put all the rocks around it. Jacob built the monument, but a fool will take the credit for what others do. This mound shall be witness, and the monument shall be witness, that I may not cross over to you past this mound, nor may you cross over to me past this mound and this monument for evil. Notice the extra condition put on Jacob for evil, as if Jacob wants to go back to Laban. And Jacob swore by the dread of his father Isaac. Then Jacob slaughtered for a feast on the mountain and summoned his kinsmen. Who supplied the feast? Laban didn't. He was riding on horseback to catch up with Jacob, who had a 3-day start. It was Jacob's flocks they had to eat. So he makes a feast on the mountain and summoned his kinsmen to break bread, and they broke bread and spent the night on the mountain. And Laban awoke early in the morning. He kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban went and returned to his place. Jacob went on his way, and angels of God encountered him. Whether it's angels or messengers, we don't know. This is the same word in Hebrew. Jacob said when he saw them, this is a godly camp. So he called the name of that place Machanaim, which means plural for camps. Then Jacob sent messengers or angels ahead of him to Esau's brother to the land of Seir, the field of Edom. He charged them, saying, thus shall you say to my master, to Esau, so said your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and have lingered until now. I have acquired oxen and donkeys, flocks, servants, and maidservants, and I am sending to tell my master to find favor in your eyes. The angels or messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we came to your brother, to Esau. Moreover, he's heading toward you, and 400 men are with him. And that's where we're going to stop today. I want us to look at what I call the anatomy of a fool. I want us to understand Laban good and well for two reasons. We all know fools. We've all suffered at the hands of fools. Some of us have acted foolishly ourselves. There might be even a fool sitting among us. If you are, I don't know that, okay? I don't have any names in mind because I don't see anybody here. I'd say, that person's a fool. I hope they're listening, because I know well enough that if you are a fool, none of this is going to make any difference to you anyway. But I don't think there are any fools here. But we are also capable of it because, as Proverbs tells us, foolishness, the nature of a fool is bound up in the heart of a child, but we can overcome it. But when someone becomes a full-grown fool, there's really no hope for them. So let's look at a few things. Now, I picked out these verses from Proverbs because every one of them in some way addresses Laban. Laban fulfilled these aspects of a fool. And so I'm going to leave it to you. I might mention a few of them, but I'm going to leave it to you as you can study these in the week. You can print this out from the website tomorrow and go through and try to figure out, okay, how did Laban fulfill this one and this one and this one? But just so we get a good idea what a fool is. It says in Proverbs 12:15, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes. But a wise man is he who listens to counsel. Isn't that something? A fool looks at what he does and thinks it's right. A wise man looks at what he thinks is right and doubts it. It doesn't seem like a wise man should ever have to doubt what the decisions he makes. But a wise man does. He always questions himself. Verse 16, Proverbs 12, 16. A fool's anger is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor. When a fool is angry, you're not going to have to wait to find out that he is. 12:23, a prudent man conceals knowledge, but a heart of a fool proclaims foolishness, folly. A fool's heart always proclaims folly. You know, the master said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Well, if a man is a fool, when he speaks, foolishness comes out. Proverbs 13:16, every prudent man acts with knowledge, but a fool displays folly. Puts it on full display. A wise man doesn't put his wisdom on display. A truly knowledgeable man doesn't always have to display his knowledge. But a fool will always display his foolishness. He always will.
What's folly?
Folly, foolishness. It's a noun form of being foolish. It's, yeah, same basic word. By the way, if you are visiting, you're allowed to ask questions. I don't know. Thank you for breaking the ice for us, Ben. If you have a question or comment, just raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you. And all right, so don't feel strange or think it's odd when someone raises it, like Jim is doing right now. So let's get a microphone to Jim. So please feel free to share. Okay, go right ahead, Jim.
If it was Jacob's mom that sent him to her forefathers or later, he had to know that he was a fool, especially when it was false gods that he was worshiping. So why was he sent there?
Why was Jacob sent to Laban if Laban was such a fool? Ah, that's a great question. And we're going to get to the answer to that right near the end. So I'm glad you, because one of the questions I have here for us to ask is, why does God allow fools in the world? Why does he, what's his purpose for fools? We're going to see what that is. It's a very important one. They do serve an important purpose. So thank you. That's a great question. Moving on, any other comments, questions? Okay, we'll move on a little bit more. I love Proverbs 14:3. It says, in the mouth of the foolish is a rod for his back. Okay, now picture that. Here's a fool. In his mouth, there's a rod, a stick. And what's the stick for? For beating himself with, or for someone to use to beat him. In other words, when a fool speaks, his foolishness will always turn out to come back to cause him pain. But because he's a fool, he never connects the pain with the cause. He never does. Because he's a fool. A fool doesn't make connections of consequences, of actions and consequences. That's beyond him. He cannot see that he suffers because he's a fool. A wise man begins to realize, I'm suffering because I was foolish, and says, I don't think I'll be foolish anymore. But a fool doesn't make the connection. But what does it say about a wise man? But the lips of the wise will protect them. So what's in the lips of a wise man? A protection for himself. I love that image. A fool has a staff that will be used to beat him, and he will never recognize, won't ever recognize the source of his pain. But a wise man, in his mouth is a shield that will protect him. I love that image. Beautiful image. Proverbs 17:12. Let a man meet a bear robbed of her cubs. Please, no, I'd rather not. But can you imagine meeting a bear, and this bear comes up on you, and you've got an armload of her cubs? Right? Okay? What's that bear going to be like? Well, it says, rather than a fool in his folly. In other words, if you had to pick one, choose the bear. Rather than a fool who's caught being a fool. The worst the bear can do is kill you. The fool will destroy your reputation. He will blaspheme your God. He will ruin the reputation of your family. He will damage everything connected to you. All the bear can do is hurt you. But the damage a fool can do, you can't even begin to estimate the degree of damage. I mean, all you have to do is look at North Korea for proof of that, right? Proverbs 17:24, wisdom is in the presence of the one who has understanding. Okay? So a person who has understanding, wisdom's right there. Kokhma, wisdom. Binah, understanding. Knowledge, da'at. And there are other words that are used. Sachal and other ones refer to these good things, these treasures we can have of truth and of wisdom, of insight, of prudence, of knowledge, understanding. These are the treasures that we should treasure because they're eternal things and you can take these with you when you die. But the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth. A wise man has his treasure right here. His wisdom is right where them. But a fool is always, you know, things have worked out well, but I've got a great idea, a plan's going to work out. So it's right over the horizon there. He's always pursuing something just out of reach. The next great idea is going to make him wealthy and famous and successful. Right? Always another great idea. That last job was awful, but this next one, this is going to be great. Proverbs 18:2, a fool does not delight in understanding, but only in revealing his own mind. A fool loves for you to hear what he thinks. Proverbs 18:6, a fool's lips bring strife, and his mouth calls for blows. Okay, remember the staff and the stick in his mouth beats him? Proverbs 23, keeping away from strife is an honor for a man, but any fool will quarrel. See, ego finds its fulfillment in being right. Fools belong to the church of being right. And they equate their self-worth with winning the argument, with being correct. And they'll argue with you about anything just for the sake of proving that they're right and you're wrong. Their opinion is more valuable than yours. That's all that matters to them. Proverbs 26:11, like a dog that returns to its vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. And they always do. I found a list on the internet that I kind of that are indicators of a fool, and I use it, but then I change it a bit and added some things to it, so I can't take credit for this list here. But here's some things: the short list. A fool uses lots of words. Why? To show off his knowledge. A fool gives subjective views, not based on real thinking, not based on truth. A fool often talks about himself, uses a lot of I's, I and me, like Laban did. You know, he says, these are my daughters, these are my children, these are my flocks, everything here is mine, 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 me, me, me. Jacob builds the stone pile of witness, and then Laban says, now this that I built. He didn't build it, but it's all about him. He boasts to impress. I did this, I did that. He's stubborn. There are no gray areas with a fool. Feels superior. He does not tolerate other viewpoints. His viewpoint's right. And there's his way or the wrong way. That's just all there is to it. A fool never admits ignorance. The three words a fool can never say is, I don't know. A fool flaunts his ambitions. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to accomplish this. I'm going to conquer that. And a fool takes credit for others' accomplishments. It couldn't have been done without me. This is a short list. I'm sure you can think of other things and find other things the scriptures add to this, but I think this pretty well sums it up. How many of you know people like this? Just me? Just oh, okay. There's a couple of people. All right. Come on, really, how many people know people like this? There we go, all right, okay. And how many of you have been people like this? Yeah. We're all capable of these things. And I know when you're reading this, here's what goes through your mind, because you're wise people. You're thinking, yeah, I know people like that, but you know what, I've been like that, and I'm kind of scared. If you see yourself as being like this, I've got good news. You're not a fool. A fool reads this and says, yeah, I know a lot of people like that, and I hate them. That's what a fool does. A wise person looks at this and sees their own weaknesses, takes warning and says, I want to work on that area because maybe this one or this one or this one are things I wrestle with. I want to conquer them. That's what a wise person does. That's what a wise person does. So if this causes you concern, we look at this list. Congratulations, you are not a fool. So the question is, what is the single underlying dynamic of a fool? The single underlying dynamic of a fool, it's this. It is the ego. It's the I. And as I said so many times before, and I'll say it into the grave, animals don't need handbooks on how to be successful animals. A horse is a horse, of course, of course. And a bird is a bird, a dog is a dog, a worm is a worm. They all do just fine. They don't have to go to worm school or bird school to be successful worms and birds. They got it. They can build their nest, they can lay their eggs, they can raise their young, they do what they do, and everything just goes, hums along. Human beings, not the case. Because see, human beings aren't merely animals. If we were, life would be easy. But we're not merely animals. Animal bodies, but a soul breathed into us from God. We're amphibians, where two worlds come together. And because of this, we need food from this world for our bodies, but we need food from that world for our souls. And that food is everything that comes out of God's mouth. Man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word, everything that proceeds from the mouth of God. And if you don't study his word, you will not know how to live as a human being. So God has given us a book. Animals don't need books. We need books. God gave us the ability to speak. We use that to learn how to read so we can know what he says. And if we don't access this book and feed upon it daily and let it be our nourishment, we will not know how to live as a human being, period. The Torah is God's handbook for being a human being. Being a human being does not come naturally. Being a fool does. Being wise does not. Are we clear on that? Okay. So we need help. But if you just live on your own, then all you have to live on is the I, the me, the my, the ego. And it'll lead you off the cliff every single time. Every single time. Nice little hand up over here. Was that Adam? Oh, it's half up. You have half a comment to share? Okay. Give him half a microphone. Okay, go right ahead, Adam. You know, that's what Rihanna says. No. I'm kidding. We're all mediocre husbands, I think. But our wives are very gracious. Yeah. Yes.
And I know for us, how we get out of it is, remember, we're actually on a team, and it's not me against her, but it's us against the obstacle.
Yeah.
And I think for the fool, you know, I work in close proximity, and most people as well, people that are not believers, and you can see they're trapped in this position of they can't have faith in divine justice. They don't have a similar plan. And I know there's one guy who just thinks he has to do everything by himself and all the way to the world on him, and I'm thinking, I don't have to deal with that because I have
Yes.
Looking out for me. And I see these other guys, and everything is just looking out for themselves. And I'm like, hey, we're on the same team because at the end of the day, we're all just people.
That's right.
It's just there's the outlook.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems to me, at least, that to be a fool would be a very lonely place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right. A fool's a lonely place, but I don't think a fool's capable of feeling lonely. I think he feels sorry for himself. But to a great degree, he doesn't think he needs people. People need him. You know, I think, was it last week I shared, I don't remember when it was, before the prayers, before the teacher, during, where how aggravated I get when people say, well, that's just the way I am. I can't change, it's just the way I am. Did I share that last week? Okay. Well, people who weren't here last week are wondering how it comes out. Well, the rest of the story is this. People who say that's just the way I am are saying I am God. Because only God gets to say, I am. I am as I am. Only God can say that and get away with it and be true. You, on the other hand, are not just who you are. You can change. You can become something. You can become more like him. But the moment you say, well, it's just the way I am, then you're doomed. And you are on the fast path to being a fool. You're in this world for one purpose, to change. And by doing so, you bring change to the world. You influence those around you. But you're here to change. And growth and life are change in this world. So work on your soul. Start changing. Work on the areas that need work. Okay? Mim, you had your hand up. Here comes the mic.
Gwen, I heard the word that people would say, I am that way.
Yeah.
You know? And the verse came into my mind about 2 Corinthians.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about how the old have passed away when we
yes.
become a believer and the new have come.
Yes.
So, as I am working toward being obedient to Torah, I can no longer say that just the way I am.
That's right.
The old has gone. The old has died.
Yeah.
We are new.
Yeah.
That's what Yeshua did for us. So we need to embrace truth and quit saying.
Right.
I need to quit saying just the way I am.
That's right.
It's excuses, right?
It's excuses. All excuses. That's right. Thank you, Ben. Very true. And over here, Ben. All right.
Two questions.
Yes.
How do you engage, let's say, with foolishness? I mean, you may not be able to do it in a moment of foolishness. And then how do you engage with maybe someone who has given over to foolishness, like about actual fool? Like, well, how do you engage with that?
All right.
Well,
you must be looking at my notes. There is no correct way to answer a fool. So, Now, I can prove there's no right way to answer a fool. Proverbs 26, verses 4 and 5. Verse 4 says, do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also become like him. Verse 5 says, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Now, you first read that and think, well, Solomon wasn't quite as smart as you've been giving him credit, because he's really contradicting himself here. No, what Solomon is doing is brilliant. He's saying, basically, darned if you do, darned if you don't. If you answer a fool, you're in trouble. If you don't answer him, you're in trouble. You can't answer him. There's nothing to do. So what do you do? Well, he answers that for us as well. Proverbs 14:7. Leave the presence of a fool. That's what you do. It's like Jacob did. Leave the presence of a fool. You leave them. One of the dumbest things you can do is try to change them. Try to cajole them. I'm going to pray for them and witness of them, and I'm going to love them into the kingdom. You're just going to burn yourself out, and you'll go on being a fool and energized by all the attention you poured into him. That's how it works. Okay? Sharon, let's get a microphone to Sharon here.
Some of the memories of our discussions about sociopaths.
Yes.
I think these two have a lot of similarities.
Oh, yes. Sociopaths are always epitomes of fools. In fact, the word fool may be the Bible word for sociopath. Yeah, may very well be. Yeah. And Dale, in the back.
What bothers me is the 400 people that are following Laban everywhere, as well as the ones back home. Yeah. It just makes me think how wide the way it is that is following the fool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, yeah, fools can follow fools. Wise men don't. So true. What is it? There's a saying that says, some people are wise and some are otherwise. And I don't want to be one of the otherwise. No. And Steve?
We had no idea what he told his family and his friends that came with him.
Who's that, Jacob or Laban? Laban.
We had no idea how he stirred them up or what he told them.
We can imagine.
And considering what he said, he took children, this.
Yeah.
He made all those accusations. He probably did the same thing.
Oh, he saw himself treated so unfairly. He truly saw himself as being robbed by Jacob. He really did. He really did. Another statement here I think is valuable. It says, even a wise man sometimes feels like a fool. But a fool never feels like a fool. He only feels angry. See, a wise man will make a mistake and he'll think, oh, that was so stupid. And then he goes about repairing the mistake he did, confessing his error to other people, confessing it to God, fixing it so it doesn't happen again. But a fool never feels like a fool. He just gets angry when he gets caught in his foolishness. Like that bear, and you've got her cubs. The question is, and this is the question Jim asked a while ago, what is God's purpose for fools? What is his purpose? Why does God put fools and so many of them in the world? Because we all encounter them. We all do. And I think the answer is to be mirrors. To be mirrors to us. Because I think the way foolishness is broken in me is when I see a fool. And I think, oh God, I don't want to be that way. But if you never saw a fool, you might not ever have that mirror to realize how foolish each of us is of being. How capable we are of being foolish. You know this verse is so well known. Proverbs 22:15. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. How many of you were a child at one time? Okay, good. All right. That means all of you at one time had foolishness bound up in your heart. It was there. Now, how many of you in your childlikeness still have some foolishness bound up there? All right, come on, let's put the hands up. All right, okay. So, how do you get rid of the foolishness that's bound up in the heart of a child? And we've heard this so many times. It says, the rod of discipline will remove it far from him. But I want us to understand what that rod of discipline is. And in Hebrew, it's shevet musar, shevet. This is the word shevet on the right, musar. And that could be translated a couple of ways. Rod of discipline or scepter of instruction. And I have news for you folks. If you don't embrace the scepter of instruction on the right, you will experience the rod of discipline on the left. Because one will work as well as the other. It's just the one's a lot less painful and embarrassing. You see, that word shevet is the word for a staff, as well as just a rod that you might use to whack somebody on the head when they're out of line, or whack a sheep on its head. The shevet. This is a word for a staff, for a scepter that a king holds. And musar. Musar is... There are many, I think there's like 9 or 10 different words, maybe 11 words that most English translations use to translate this word, as it's found in so many places in Scripture. But when you see the word musar, think discipleship. And in Judaism, there are many works of musar. And the rabbis, the sages, always encourage every person to be a student of Musar, to find a teacher of Musar, to read books on Musar. Because Musar is how to live a wise and godly life. How to correct the character issues each of us has. How to break the bad habits. How to up the ante, become more righteous, more obedient. To exercise more control over those areas in our life that tend to go out of control. That's what Musar is. And we can embrace it as a scepter that is held in the king's hand. Or we can experience as a rod that's brought down on our back. But Musar, and only Musar, will drive foolishness out of the hearts that every one of us is born with. And I still have foolishness in my heart that still has to be driven out. God says, you can go easy, you can go hard. If you go hard on yourself, I'll go easy on you. If you go easy on yourself, I will go hard on you. But you can have the rod or you can have the scepter. It can come as physical pain and discipline in your life, or it can come as instruction in your mind that you embrace and value and love, and you incorporate it into your will. So, when you read that verse, when you think of your kids when they act foolish, realize there are two ways to understand it. Don't just reach for the switch each time your kids are out of line. Be wise. Be wise in how you bring Musar into their hearts and minds. Okay? I wish I had known this when my kids were little. I wish I had known that. Caleb's back there nodding. Yeah, Dad, I wish you had. Okay, I saw a hand up over here. Yes, David.
Of course, Greg, we have to be able to recognize foolishness. And take appropriate action and protection. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think our heart has to go out, because those behaviors, when I see them in people, if it's really defining who they are, mm-hmm. that's someone who has been extremely hurt.
Yes.
Especially when they were a child. Mm-hmm. And it's just helpful for me when I'm experiencing that kind of thing, and I hope other people have the same graciousness for me when I do those things, and to recognize, I'm much less frustrated when I recognize that's coming from a deep place of hurt.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, how's a fool become a fool? Well, apparently, the foolishness that is bound up in their heart as a child was never dealt with. And also, David, you bring up something that's so important. What makes you understand something? Every human being is capable of foolishness. All of us are, and all of us will do something foolish in the future. So make a distinction between someone who is truly a committed, card-carrying fool and one who just did something foolish. I don't paint them with a broad brush. There are a few people in this life I know who are just are blatant fools. They just really are fools. They're committed to it. But other people, which is all the rest of us, can be foolish. Just be foolish. And so, and here's the solution. Here's the solution, okay? God brings pain into our lives to teach us not to be foolish. But he also provides instruction to us. So seek out his instruction. Seek out that instruction. And learn, become wise people, willingly. Commit yourself to wisdom. And then you won't have to experience the rod of discipline so much in your life. It makes sense, right? It's not that complicated. You all are wise. I tell you what, for the sake of time, and I see the clock now is just struck noon, I want to go over these last few details, and then we'll, if you want, we'll take a few more comments and questions. Is that okay? I told you we would address the question of why did Rachel steal Laban's teraphim. I thought about this, and I came up with four possibilities, and you could probably think of five, six, seven. First of all, she herself was wicked and idolatrous. I just can't believe that. Because she's one of the matriarchs. We have Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. We bless our children, our little girls, in the names of Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. I don't think God would include an idol worshiper, a wicked person, a thief, in that group. Now, maybe she just did something foolish once. That's a possibility. But I don't think she herself was wicked. I don't think she was idolatrous. Maybe she wanted to punish Laban. I mean, she had plenty to be angry at her dad for. After all, he's the one who swapped brides on her wedding night, right? Maybe she wanted to rescue Laban from idolatry. I know what. I'll just steal his gods. I don't think it changes and makes an idolater into a non-idolater. Maybe she was thinking of the legend about Abraham. I don't know if it existed at that time or not. Maybe it was true. But the story goes that when Abraham lived in the land of Ur, his father made a living carving idols, making idols of whatever they're made out of. And he had a shop where he could go and buy idols. And so one night, Abraham goes in there, smashes up all the idols, except for one. Then he takes the hammer and puts it in the hand of this last idol who's standing. In the morning, his dad comes into the shop, and he sees this mess, and he suspects Abraham, because Abraham's been going on about there's only one God, and these idols aren't doing anything. So he calls Abraham in and gets real excited about it and hollers at him. And why did you do this? And Abraham says, well, maybe that idol there with the hammer smashed up the rest. And his dad said, well, idols can't swing hammers. They can't do anything. But Abraham looks at his dad and says, then why do you worship them? Why do you make them? You see? It's a wonderful story. If it wasn't true, it should be. So maybe Rachel was aware of this. So she thought, you know, Abraham, he dealt with idols in his way. I'll deal with them in my way, with my father, as Abraham did with his. Possible. I think the fourth one is the right one, though. This is where I'm going to put my check mark right there. She thought Laban would use them to divine their location. Because Laban, as we looked at last week, he was a diviner. He claimed, at least, to be able to divine things, figure out the future, and get information supernaturally. So they're fleeing from Laban. And she knows that her dad has it within him to come and kill Jacob, take them all back as just to abduct them and take them back and take all the flocks. She knew he was capable of that. She did not know that God appeared to Laban in a dream to warn him, don't you do anything, not a lie. So maybe she thought, I'll just take his radar detector, and so he can't find us, basically. You understand? So I think that is probably it. But something to think about. Anyways, this is something I do want us to look at. Just take a couple minutes. We'll talk about this more next week. I want us to think about Jacob. And if I know you're getting tired, just hang with me a couple more minutes. Jacob had been back here with Laban for at least 20 years that we know of. But Jacob wants to go to his father, to Isaac, and to the land of his fathers, Abraham and Isaac. And God had given him instructions to go. But there are two opposing forces, two things trying to keep Jacob from accomplishing his goal. One is Laban chases after him. And if Laban could have, he would have killed Jacob at worst, abducted him and everything was his, and bring them back by force at the best. On the other hand, there's someone up ahead who's riding toward him with 400 men. And maybe Laban wanted to kill Jacob, we don't know, but Esau stated, I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill him dead. He stole my birthright, and then he stole my blessing. And when Isaac, my father, dies, I'm going to go and kill my twin brother Jacob. I'm going to kill him. And Esau had the ability to do that. He was a hunter. He was a trapper. He was a man of the field. He was a guy who knew how to kill. So there's one behind chasing him. There's one ahead coming towards him. And Jacob was filled with fear. How do we know this? He says so. In Genesis 31:31, Jacob replied to Laban, because I was afraid. Why did you take off, Jacob? I was afraid. For I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. I thought you would steal your daughters, my wives, back. He feared Laban because he thought he was going to steal. But next week we'll read in chapter 32, verse 11, Jacob prays to God, says, "Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come, not to steal, but attack me and the mothers with the children." He's fearing Esau because he's afraid he's going to kill him. Jacob's in between a rock and a hard place, isn't he? Laban behind, Esau ahead, but God says go. Kind of where all of us are. But I think it's kind of the story of the Jewish nation. On the one hand, they've got a Laban, someone they're not directly related to too much by blood, who's chasing after him. This is a picture of the world. Just the persecution of the world. Just always after them. To take what the Jews have. The Jewish people have been blessed by a God, and because they're blessed by God, they often have wealth and abilities and talents. And the world wants to use them and take them away as fast as they can. The world is like a Laban to the Jewish people, the children of Jacob. But Esau, what is Esau always in Jewish thought? Represents what? Rome. And not just Rome, the empire, but the Roman religion of Christendom. Okay, in the Jewish mind, when you see Esau, Edom, we've talked about this before, it always represents Rome. Not just the empire, the government of Rome, but the church of Rome. Because so much persecution, so much death and martyrdom has come at the hands of people who claim to be followers of Christ, but who really aren't. They're religious, but they're not spiritual. Now we know how God dealt with Laban. What did he do? He warned Laban, "Don't you lay a hand on him. I'm watching him." So Laban, the fool, comes up. There's a lot of bluff and bluster, but then Laban goes away. What's going to happen between Jacob and Esau? They're going to embrace. But something happens in both of their lives. What's going to happen in Jacob's life? He's going to wrestle with God. And that we'll see next week. God's going to change Jacob in a profound way. Change his name from Jacob to Yisrael. And then what happens when he meets Esau? Esau's coming at him with 400 men. So how many men are coming in all? 401. Esau and 400 men. Do you know what the numerical or the Hebrew equivalent of 401 is? Aleph and Tav. First letter and last letter of Hebrew alphabet. Aleph is equal to 1, Tav is equal to 400, 401. That's not a coincidence. And when Jacob meets Esau, instead of an attack, there's an embrace. They weep on one another's necks. And Jacob takes the blessing of wealth and all those things Esau is afraid he's going to lose by losing the blessing, Jacob freely gives him. This is a very prophetic thing we see happening here. And we know how the story ends. And we live in a time, it's so exciting, and this is one of the reasons Beth Tikun exists, why God is raising up Beth Tikun's messianic congregations around the world. Because Esau's hearts, the hearts of believers, are turning towards the Jews. They're embracing their brothers. They're twins, after all. You want to be technical, Esau's Jewish too. They were twins. They're in the womb at the same time. But the one who often wanted to kill Jacob is now riding to him to embrace him. But Jacob doesn't know that. But the Jewish people are beginning to realize that we're loving them. And we're beginning to realize they're starting to recognize Messiah. They're wrestling with God. God's bringing about a change in their hearts and minds. And it's a slow motion process. We're seeing it played out in slow motion. But it's happening. Isn't it a beautiful picture? Amazing picture. So I want you to be thinking about this as you study chapter 32 for next week. And I think we better close. All right? Our Father and King, thank you so much for the wonders that are found in your Torah. thanking you for opening our eyes to see them. So, Lord, we pray for our Jewish brothers and sisters, that, Father, as you wrestle with them in the dark, they will come to recognize you in the light. And, Father, that when they finally continue their approach toward us, we would approach them with love and with an embrace. And the two that had been separated for so long, for 20 years, for 2,000 years, would come together to become one again. Father, bring that about. May we live that our eyes may behold this, reach completion. In the meantime, help us to continue to grow in wisdom, to be the people you want us to be, to put foolishness out of our lives, and to practice musar, discipline, and godly living and righteousness in our lives. Make us disciples of the Master, we ask in the Master's name. Amen.